Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
But we start the hour with a story of two fishing guides who formed a surprising friendship. Here's NPR's Mike Edgerly.
If you've gone to the Bahamas, specifically to Grand Bahama Island, and more specifically to the east end of Grand Bahama Island, you've probably gone there to fish. And you've most likely gone there to fish for bonefish. Chris Dombrowski went to the east end of Grand Bahama Island to fish, all right, to take a break from his life as a Montana fishing guide, a father, and a poet. And what he found was fish. And he found a friendship with a former fishing guide whose eyes were cloudy with cataracts from the sun, but whose vision in his later years was as clear as the water around the island. Body of Water is Chris Dombrowski's story of his journey and that of his new friend, David Pinter. Pinter was not only the first Bahamas bone fishing guide, but perhaps the best ever. This older, gentle, and very human man who seemingly was blind. But he shared with Chris how to see fish, but also how to observe, learn lessons about memory, knowledge, loyalty, and living a good life. Body of Water is published by Milkweed Editions and is released this month. You know, Chris, I was thinking earlier if we'd had the opportunity, we should have gotten David Pinter on the phone. I'd like to hear his side of the story of your relationship with him. He's quite a grand gentleman, isn't he?
Absolutely, Mike. I'll be interested to hear what he has to say about the book. I think he's portrayed, as you say, as a man of great rectitude and poise. He's such a humble man, though. I'm not sure he will love being sainted, if you will.
Well, what might he think if he were to know that a couple of guys are sitting 1,700 miles north of where he lives in a studio in Minnesota talking about a book that really raises who he is and brings who he is to an audience who may have never heard his name.
Absolutely. I know he will be humbled by it because that's his nature. I think his family seems to me very excited about this because they have waited decades or even generations for his story to be brought to,
really?
to the forefront. Absolutely.
They thought that one day someone might appear on their doorstep with a fly rod and the capacity to tell a story.
I think so. His daughter, Delcina, is a very spiritual woman, and she told me, you know, I prayed for this day for years.
Take us to the beginning. How did you end up on Grand Bahama Island, on the East End, at McLeanstown, and meeting David Pinter? Can you just give us in your own words, just how did this all come about?
Sure. Well, my original journey began with purely fishing motivations. I was the guest of a dear friend who had fished for three or four decades out of East End with David Pinter and David's sons. And my friend Miller said, you should meet this man, David Pinter. He started the whole bone fishing industry. You know, he worked for $5 a day back in 1958 when my father was first coming here. And I was much more excited to go fishing and to tie into my first bonefish than to meet some grand gentleman, as you say. And so I met David in my first journey, but I was not made aware of his largeness of spirit and of accomplishment. So the second trip down there, I was working on basically what I call a scratch fishing piece, just a little how-to, where-to piece for an outdoors journal. And it was in that second journey that the kind of grace and greatness of this man started to pervade my purpose down there.
Right. You were looking for just a break from your life at a time when, as a guide yourself, a father, a soon-to-be new father, you needed just a break from Montana and your life, and there you were. I mean, what a serendipitous moment, not just for David Pinter, but for you.
Oh, yeah.
Something was delivered to you as well as to him, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely. Much more to me, I think, for sure. And interestingly enough, as you say, I was looking for an escape. And many of us travel to the tropics, or many people have traveled to see me in Montana out of some level of escapism, I think. But what I ended up finding in his life and in this ecosystem and community that he has cultivated for decades was really a deeper immersion with place. And somehow, miraculously, that deeper immersion translated to my life back in Montana and my own guiding and my own vocation, if you will, as a guide. So quite an amazing connection, for sure.
I'd like to ask you about the book itself. It's on its surface, it's about a professional fly fishing guide going to the Bahamas, meeting a fellow guide, a venerable guide, the man who created an industry, mm-hmm. in fact. But yet it's so much more than that. I mean, I'm just curious how this in your writer's consciousness began to unfold, that this isn't just a travel piece or a how-to piece. That when was the recognition that this was really a much more than about fishing? It's about vision in a way that's even beyond what eyes can deliver.
Well, I'm a slow learner, so it took many drafts, I think. But a good friend of mine, who's a writer, who happens to have written a book about fishing, a man named David James Duncan, who wrote The River Why, he read an early draft of the book, which was largely 3 or 4 or 5 long travel essays stitched together. And he forefronted the last of these, which happened to focus much more on David's life, and said, here's your subject right mm-hmm. here. So that, coupled with the reading of a very obscure old text, Dogen's Mountains and Waters Sutra, which is largely about how place can pervade a psyche or a being, and how if given the right attention, that that same thing, that same process can happen in its inverse. And I started to think about how David Pinder had not only lived on this island, this tiny little island off the east end of Grand Bahama, but had himself become kind of an island. And and that connection, if I'm not talking too long about this, brought me back to a book I love called The Meadow by James Galvin, which is a book largely about the Neversummer Mountains in the Colorado-Wyoming borderlands. And it focuses on a man named Lyle who lived as a hermit, if you will, a very elemental life. So I began to see parallels between Pinder's life and Lyle in Galvin's work. Mm-hmm. And like I said earlier, after you asked, I'm not sure how David will feel about it. He's such a humble man that he might feel a little uneasy about the attention and the praise he's been given. But
right, just a couple of words about David Pinder. He was this pioneering guide. He helped build an industry, a lodge that is going today. He's penniless, in effect, by our standards, perhaps.
Sure.
He leads a simple life. He's surrounded by grandchildren and children, and about half of his children have become fishing guides, following in his footsteps. But yet he's not a hermit, is he? He's so rich in so many ways. That must have occurred to you at some point,
so,
the wealth
right.
this man had accrued.
Right, and the purpose with which he has lived his life is, I think it's a rare occurrence. A reviewer recently said that they thought body of water was about worth. And that was a wonderful thing to discover. It's something I hadn't really thought of. Certainly the book touches on economics, but the worth of one's life, or the worth of a life spent immersed in the landscape. You can't look at David Pinder, I can't anyway, and not see an incredibly enlightened and joyful man, despite
right.
the fact that, as you say, by our standards, he's basically penniless.
Now, he was, expelled from the lodge he helped create, mm-hmm. literally block by block, stone by stone, mm-hmm. Because his eyesight had failed. And in fact, he has cataracts. But yet you were on the water with him. And what I gather from Body of Water is that this guy could put you on a fish, if not by sight, by feel, by intuition, by vibrations. He knew something before the fish knew they were doing something.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah. And in that scene you describe, I was with Miko, who's probably the most famous guide in the Bahamas. He's Senior's grandson, and Miko guides the Liam Neesons and the Michael Keatons of the world, and also with William, who is Senior's son. And so I was not I wasn't making this up, you know, when I watched David Pinder Sr. point out these fish to me before, once or twice, even before his progeny saw them. So, yeah, it's quite remarkable. I think the further and further we get back into our instinctual or reptilian brain, the more we notice. And I think someone who has operated via instinct or impulse for a long time in one place has a connection with it that's kind of singular.
Right. And that's common even to those of us who love to fish in mm-hmm. less exotic locations. Mm-hmm. The more we fish, and you as a professional probably recognize the absence of this, but when you fish a lot, and you're tuned in and you're observing, you aren't conscious of what you're doing. You just know there's something going on, right? It's the light or a bug or a flash, right? And he was tuned into this. He was able to communicate this without perfect sight.
Absolutely. And like you say, it's an occurrence that many of us who have spent time on the water have felt. Maybe the wind changed and tuned our attention to something we hadn't already seen, and or we heard something, or our brain that exists beyond our brain heard something and tapped us back into that kind of Pleistocene way of being.
Right. As a guide, you take people out to catch fish for money. It's a transaction. It seemed, at least from the early parts of your book, you had regarded the work you had been doing as a transactional. Mm-hmm. But yet for David Pinder, it seemed different for him. Even though he was doing it for money and for his career, it wasn't a transaction for him, was it so much?
No, I don't think so. I think he believed that he had been born to do this. He was, as the book describes, working on a missile detection base off near Freeport when a man named Gil Drake, who had just purchased an island from the Crown, was looking for someone to, as you say, help clear the mangroves, basically. And so when David Pinder met Gil Drake, and a few months later, Drake asked, "Well, do you know what this little fish looks like that goes in the shallow water, goes running around and is very skittish?" Of course, David Pinder said, "I do. You know, I've seen them my entire life." So I believe he felt called to that way of being. And I think the fact that his sons and grandsons now, and maybe great-grandsons soon, have entered into this industry and done it with great success, and that it's become really the act upon which the Bahamian Ministry of Tourism bases its faith, gives him some feeling of accomplishment, if you will.
Right, right. I guess for the uninitiated, this idea of pursuing a fish in shallow water with a fly rod may seem a little odd, but the Bahamian coins, one of them has a bonefish on
it, does, yeah,
right?
Two, sure.
And so that it's so integral to the culture and to the economy that it's hard to overstate what David Pinder meant to the Bahamas, and yet he lives with some rusted out automobiles,
sure,
in his front yard,
right? No, I hope that, I really hope that this book will lead to people looking at him in a different light. But I also know that if there's anyone I've ever met in my life who has lived a life with purpose and not seeking attention, that person is David Pinder. And as you touched upon, one of the things we're looking for when we fish is some dissolution of the ego, you know, and the closer, the more we become attuned to that brain behind our brain, that is beyond thought or worry or even motivation, that just becomes immersed in attention to the natural world, the less one becomes concerned with all that other stuff at all. And I think David is someone for whom that is, that way of being is simply ingrained.
Is he aware of the importance he played to the bone fishing industry and to the east end of the Grand Bahama Island, the Bahamas themselves, itself? Is he aware of who he is?
That's a great question. I know his children are, and his grandchildren, but he is an artist. What he did was, as a guide, was artistry. And I think, as any artist would say, the amount of struggle and effort that goes into a work sometimes doesn't allow one to step back and see accomplishment, if you will.
Mm-hmm. I assume, as a poet, poets don't make a whole lot of a dough, and they're not on the front page of the newspapers unless they win the Nobel Prize and they're from northern Minnesota and they sing songs, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you obviously loved this man or felt something strong, a kinship and an affection for him. This really became something other than this wasn't a transaction, this book, right?
No, absolutely. And that's one of the real grace notes, I think, of about the book for me, is that I really met someone who not only became a viable subject for a book, but also someone who helped change the compass of the compass needle of my life and point me in a different direction. So,
how did it change the direction of your life?
Well, as you said early on in the book, dates and time periods are always a little muddy for a poet, but early on in the book, I had worked for almost 12 or 13 years as a guide, and I was kind of awash in this world of a schizophrenic world, if you will, where I would teach half of the year as a poet and then work half of the year as a guide. And I had less and less time for my own writing, not enough time for my own family, and yet there was the need for money and the need for career advancement, etc. And all of that combined to make a very messy primordial soup. And so discovering someone like David, who had lived with intense purpose and direction and seemingly one goal, which was to remain immersed in this landscape and to glean the riches each day that landscape offered, that in turn offered me great purpose. Mm-hmm. And so I feel, you know, lucky isn't the right word, but more than lucky to have encountered him and been touched by it.
And he accepted you as a fellow guide, as did his offspring and the other guides that you met. How did that make you feel as a Montana river guide, to be accepted by this class of angler?
Well, that was a lovely thing, and I think a fortunate thing, because without that, I would have been, you know, a travel writer, if you will. And I doubt that the ironies and some of the dark histories of Bahamian economy, I don't know that they would have been opened up to me. So maybe it was lovely. And I actually have had the great fortune of hosting Miko, who's Senior's grandson, and Miko's family up in Montana, and to watch their amazement at encountering the Rocky Mountain landscape for the first time was lovely for me to see kind of at a distance what it must have been like for me to set foot on the Bahamian Flats for the first time. So, when I go down to see Mervyn or to fish with Miko, these guides in the book, it's real fellowship. It's awesome.
Right. And is there a sense that you share an awareness of the sacredness of water with these guides? Do they view that the way you discuss it in the book? To them, the idea of going to water to heal, mm-hmm. does that resonate with them, or is it even a part of the language, the culture?
Yeah. I doubt it does. I'm not sure. I think they would probably find that much of it was romanticized but they do know, I'm sure, and they have seen millions of times what happens to the clients who come down from wherever, Baltimore, St. Louis, San Diego, who come down and by the third day of fishing on the flats with them look like completely different people because their burdens have kind of been dissipated, or the ego that they had paid so much attention to disappeared. So I'm sure if they don't talk about that phenomenon, they've witnessed it a lot.
Right. They understand a transformation is possible, right? And it's how they make their dough. But what I was struck with was just how perceptive these guides are, not just in terms of pursuit of fish, but of their mm-hmm. understanding of human nature. I mean, you relate the story of a couple of mm-hmm. one of the guides, maybe it was Mervyn or Miko, who mm-hmm. had a couple that were
sure.
I mean, they were coming to blows in right. the boat, and his utter understanding of human nature was just, well, it was just an amazing story.
Right. You know, there's an old review of the poet Mary Oliver, who's kind of a beloved nature poet, and this review is by a writer named Stephen Dobbins, and he says, there aren't many humans in these poems that Mary Oliver writes, and yet we glean more about humanity from them than from anyone else. And I think that's something that these guides at the east end of Grand Bahama have done more of than anyone in our world anyway, and that is watch creatures in the natural world behave and interact with one another. And I think, as you described that scene with Mervyn and the couple who are fighting, it's pretty easy to see when people are acting like animals and pretty easy to see when they're acting like humans.
The common thread that runs through a guide's life and maybe even a more than adequate angler is observant, being observant. Mm-hmm. But that's also a noun, right? If you're an observant, you're adhering mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. perhaps a spiritual belief. Mm-hmm. There's a strong thread of spirituality through this book, isn't there? Do you consider yourself spiritual, religious?
I think I do. I mean, I think it's much easier for me to exist in the natural world. You know, Dogen has a line, the palace of ordinary people, which I adopt somewhere in the book. And I certainly have felt very much that water has become a sanctuary for me over the last 20 or so years. I'm not sure if I'm evading your question sufficiently enough there.
Oh, I think you're evading it quite adequately. But there is something, and other writers, contemporary mm-hmm. writers, have written about mm-hmm. their characters who go to the water to heal, to become, mm-hmm. you know, to immerse oneself in something which is not escaping from something, but actually escaping into something.
Right. And, you know, David Pinder Sr. has a line late in the book, which is, I often have to remind myself that he said this, that this man who has lived on a tiny island at the east end of Grand Bahama has not read, quote, the great wisdom texts or anything like that. That this man said, after I asked him if he felt water was a necessary healing element in his life, he talked about the water that exists inside our bodies, you know, the percentage of water that we are, and how when we encounter that, when we encounter water in the natural world, it is some kind of alchemical equilibrium writing takes place. And he said to me, when you think about it, water proves everything. And
what a beautiful line.
A stunning line. I mean, absolutely unreal that this man could come up with something like that. And I think that, yes, there we have some core inside us that longs to be reconnected with that which we really are. And in large part, I think that's one of the philosophical themes of the book.
Right. Where do you go from here? You've published books of poetry. You've published now Body of Water.
That's a great question.
How do you follow that? How do you follow that?
Well, I'm already at work on the next book of prose, which is tentatively titled The Nature of Wonder, and which Milkweed has under contract, and I am under deadline for. So I'll be working on that through the winter and hopefully completing another book of poems sometime soon. So, yeah, the next thing I'm looking really forward to doing is heading down to McLeanstown and putting a pile of books at David Pinder's doorstep.
I wish you much success.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Chris.
My pleasure.
Chris Dombrowski is a fishing guide, poet, and author of Body of Water, which has just been released by Milkweed Editions.